Hey guys, this is Mindset Win, the Red Bull podcast that gives you the tools to become better at what you do. I am your host, Lisa Ramoschkat, and before we dig into today's episode, I just wanted to thank you so much for tuning into episode number one. For everyone who left us their comments or reached out to us over email, it means the world to us, and personally, I'm just so excited to be on this journey with you. But let's get back to today's episode and today's conversation, which I had a couple of weeks ago with F1 reserve driver Liam Lawson.
They told me a Formula One career from New Zealand is basically impossible. Even when I was told as a kid, it's impossible, you can't do it, it would be in one ear and out the other and I would just carry on.
Liam is a graduated junior team driver and currently a reserve driver for Oracle Red Bull Racing as well as Visa Cash App RB. But most of you probably know him from his last minute F1 debut back in 2023 at the Dutch Grand Prix as he replaced the injured Daniel Ricciardo. Today's episode will be all about being patient, being prepared at all times, and never giving up on your dreams.
Obviously, I'm aiming to be a full-time driver, and finishing off, it was realizing that now there's not really much more I can do to prove myself. I just kind of have to sit and wait a little bit and let things play out.
So let's get right into it. This is Mindset Win with Liam Lawson. Welcome to Mindset Win, Liam Lawson. So excited to have you here, to have you on the show. And we're actually having a kind of a transatlantic situation here. We're catching you all the way over in New Zealand in the pretty cool setup of a pretty solid music studio. What's the story behind that?
Yeah, it's firstly, thanks for having me. It's a unique sort of time. Normally at this period of the year, I wouldn't be in New Zealand, but Formula One decided to put Melbourne and Japan on the calendar together, which was quite cool. And it means that rather than going all the way back to Europe after Melbourne, it makes more sense to stay here. So yeah, it's nice to be home for a week or so, catch up obviously with friends and family for the last time, probably for the year. And that's why I'm in the studio doing this.
Man, for the last time throughout the year, for the whole year, it's only, I mean, early in the year, but crazy. Looking at your vlogs, it really shows that you do care about music. You play guitar yourself, at least. I heard you sing a little bit. How big of a music fan are you really, though?
It's something that I was sort of introduced to as a kid. My dad's has played music his whole life, so he got me and my brother into guitar when we were both very, very young, around the time that I started go-kart racing. So yeah, it's something I've been playing sort of my whole life. I did have a few years off, so I'd say my skill level is a lot less than it used to be, but it's cool to, it's something I realized was quite a nice way to sort of take your mind off things, relax after a race weekends, sort of de-stress after the intense things that we deal with on Formula One weekends. So yeah, something I enjoy doing.
Only to de-stress, or does it help you to get into the zone as well?
Listening to music definitely helps get in the zone. Playing music is something to de-stress, I would say. But yeah, I think listening to music is something I've done before races since I was quite young as well. It's a nice environment to put yourself into. Takes your mind away from the sort of how busy it is at a racetrack.
Yeah, let's actually take it to the racetrack now, because obviously we're not here to only talk about your music, but also about your day job, if you want to call it that. Maybe you can start out and explain to myself and the audience your role really as a reserve driver within the team.
Yeah, so as a Formula One reserve, it's obviously an amazing opportunity, and it's very, very close to being a Formula One driver. And I guess what the role consists of is actually quite similar to driving the car. We basically do everything a driver does except drive the car. So in some ways, obviously, it's frustrating to watch, and I'm a terrible spectator, and I always have been. So, but basically, away from the track, it's mostly development work. The main drivers won't have as much time as we will to spend in the simulator and actually develop the car. So that's something that the teams use reserves for, to do sort of a lot more hours in the simulator behind the scenes. And then at the racetrack, all the debriefs, the meetings, I sit in and I listen to. And then during the session, I have a headset on and I'm basically listening to all radio communications and basically seeing everything that happens. So it's it's on the week, on the actual race weekends, it's probably more of a learning opportunity for us to see it. Formula One's very different to every other racing championship, and it's something that definitely takes time to adjust to. So to have that opportunity now before driving is actually really good.
And you just said you do basically everything except for actually driving the car, which is the only thing that you really want to do, exactly. Right? And I can't imagine it being so hard. You use the word frustrating, to be like this ambitious, young, aspiring athlete, but, you know, having to wait all this time while at the same time keeping yourself ready and in the zone and, you know, motivated and at 100 to be ready to jump in at any time. How do you balance that? And what would you say are the most important virtues? Probably something like patience, which I hate.
Yeah, it's basically that. It's, I think it's obviously at times it's very frustrating, and at times you, it's potentially, well, it's not enjoyable as well at certain times, but it's something that's knowing the opportunity I have, knowing how, especially from being from New Zealand, how rare and hard it is to be on the edge of Formula One. It's just reminding myself basically that it's a crazy opportunity I have. Yeah, and I think it's different now as well. I have a different perspective having raced last year versus before that, having never raced before. You never really know what it's like. You imagine what it's like to be in Formula One. And but now that I've done it, it's a different perspective. And maybe, I don't know, it's a different perspective. So maybe it's good and bad at the same time.
So now you got me curious. What is the biggest difference between imagining what it's like and then actually being in the car? What was the main thing for you?
I think it's very easy to overthink situations and overthink what it's going to be like. So I think away from, well, before Formula One, obviously you have to have self-confidence. Every driver has to have that self-confidence to basically tell themselves that they're good enough for it. You know, we wouldn't really be able to get close to it without having that self-belief. So I always told myself I was good enough for F1, but all the scenarios, driving the car, dealing with the amount of people in the team, and thinking about life situations, I'd like to say that I'm pretty realistic about things, and I always expected it to be very, very tough, which it was, but also at the same time, when I raced, realizing that it's basically just like racing another car. So all the procedures, getting ready for a race, and the stuff that comes with Formula One, the media, everything like that, that's something I was never ready for. But when the lights go out and you're in a race, it's just like any other race. You're right. It's just like any other situation that you've been in growing up, racing go-karts, going through entry-level cars. It's a lot faster, but you're still racing other people and you're still trying to go as fast as you can.
So interesting how you said you have to have that self-belief, you have to have the confidence to actually be able to make it. Where does that come from? You said that you tell yourself or told yourself that. Is that like an inherent thing, or did you have to learn that? Plus, I heard that it's not very common, or like a common thought over there in New Zealand, to think it to be possible for anyone to actually make it in F1.
Yeah, and I think that's what I was lucky to be born with, honestly, because I think that's really where it stems from. Is not something I learned over time. It's something I was born with. So when I realized from a very young age that Formula One was the pinnacle of motorsport and that it was what I wanted to do, from the age of 6 years old, starting go-karts, I would, you know, tell my dad and I'd tell everybody around me that I wanted to be a Formula One driver. So which a lot of kids do, but as you get older and sort of things become more realistic, a lot of people would maybe become more real about it and say, okay, maybe it's too difficult. But for some reason, it was never something that, even when I was told as a kid, it's impossible, you can't do it. It's, you know, you don't have the money, it's too expensive. For some reason, it was never something that bothered me. It wasn't like, when somebody would tell me that, it wasn't like I would go, oh, that sucks. I would just kind of, it would be in one ear and out the other, and I would just carry on. So, I think I'm fortunate to basically have been born with that belief.
And you already mentioned how you were in go-karting and, you know, started out early and all that kind of stuff. why would you focus on F1 so much though? What would be the fascination for you personally there?
I think what separates Formula One is basically just that it's the pinnacle. So I'm extremely competitive, and I have been since I was young. So obviously I was competitive through racing go-karts, but even in just everyday life situations, it's something that I don't know if I'm cursed with it or not, but I'm ultra competitive about everything. So I think it was realizing that Formula One is the highest level, and that if I wanted to be the best, that I would need to be a Formula One driver and I would need to win in Formula One. And I think that's why the attraction came towards Formula One.
But then how did you actually commit to, you know, this vision of yours to actually make it a reality? You told your dad to start with, and then how did it, you know, roll out over the years? And when did it become clear, would you say, that you would actually have to leave New Zealand all the way over to Europe probably in order to have a shot at this?
I think it was something that I was lucky. My dad was always, my dad would always tell me I could do and be whatever I wanted to be, which I was very fortunate of. So of all the people that would, you know, maybe say that it's not possible and that it's very unrealistic, my dad was never one of those people. Or my mum, both my parents basically were very supportive, and all through go-karts, basically would tell me that I could be whatever I wanted to be. So I would say that's probably where that sort of self-confidence and that belief came from, that it was possible. But obviously a lot of things had to happen over the years for that all to line up. So I've been extremely lucky to have amazing support from New Zealand, and a lot of people, individuals, companies in New Zealand that have sort of backed me from a young age. And looking over the years, it's hard to sort of pinpoint exactly, you know, the decisions that we made. At the time, we didn't really know sometimes whether they were the right decisions, but everything sort of lined up. And then when I was 16, going into the 2019 season, I had no plan of what we were doing, and not much money, but Red Bull came along basically right at that time and basically picked me up. And without that, there's no way any of this would have happened.
What, listening you say, I didn't have a plan, that gives me anxiety, man. What was that like for you though?
Yeah, it was, again, I don't know if I was just too young to realize, but even at 16, I was going into basically a championship. It's called the Toyota Racing Series in New Zealand. I just competed in Formula 4 in Germany. It was my first international European racing season, and we just managed to sort of raise the costs to go and do the season in Germany. And the idea behind raising the money was that we would never raise enough money to go to Formula One. It was to raise enough money to try and get picked up by a junior team, because that was the only way we could see that it was possible to go as far as Formula One. So we went to the highest level F4 championship, which at the time was the German championship. Mm-hmm. And I competed in it. I didn't get a contract from that season. I finished seconds in the championship, and basically we'd planned on doing the Toyota Racing Series over January, over that sort of off season in Europe. And the championship has always basically drawn in a lot of international drivers, because it was the only championship that would run over the off season of Europe. It would run over January, but in New Zealand it's summertime. So you'd race high level cars, high level drivers from all sorts of different championships. But I went into that season over January with no plan of what we were doing afterwards, and basically knew that I had 5 weeks to try and get a contract. And after the very first weekends, we had a Red Bull contract.
Just out of nothing.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's, you know, it sounds like just,
yeah, the timing,
luck,
yeah, it is. And it's something that's that I can, you know, very easily say I've been extremely lucky at times to have the timing of this to work out like it has.
You really have to have the guts to like take on this gamble though, which kind of brings me to your family, because they invested so much into your career, in you, in order to make this big dream of yours happen. And I even heard that your sisters dropped their pro Irish dancing careers, which I find crazy. Do you ever feel maybe like pressured, or like you owe them something maybe?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely feel like I owe them a lot. My parents especially, But as you said, my whole family as well, my siblings, since I was very, very young, go-karting is, especially top-level go-karting, is extremely expensive. And what started, I mean, in my head, I always knew I wanted to be a Formula One driver, but when you're 6 years old and you're starting go-karts, at that first point that you start out, it's a fun sport. It's not, you're not doing it to plan out your career. In my head I was, but to my dad, obviously it's more of a fun thing to do. So when you realize, when that sort of fun, I guess, father-son sport turns into, you know, a serious sport, and then you start having to spend the money that you need to be able to race at top level, even in go-karts, it's crazy expensive. So, yeah, when I was probably 10 years old, racing go-karts, both my sisters were national level Irish dancers. They would go overseas to compete. And they basically had to stop doing it because of how expensive everything was. My parents had sold their house to basically keep me racing in go-karts. And now basically, yeah, we're at the point where everybody else, you know, from around our team, not just family members, but everybody else has come on board and sort of made this happen. But I definitely owe my family a huge amount, and I definitely love to repay them in some form in the future.
Would you say, though, that this kind of followed you into some of the races that you went into? I'm just trying to imagine this myself. I would feel much more pressured.
I think it's never done that because they've never let it sort of affect me in that way, or they've never put that pressure on me. They've never made it out like I owed them anything. I guess my family's always been or believed in trying to give us kids like the best possible life, and if we wanted to do something, they would try and make that happen whatever way they could. So it was never made clear to me that it was a massive sacrifice from them. So it was something that I probably learned as I got older, and realized how expensive this stuff is and realistically what they were doing. I probably realized myself what a sacrifice it was, but it was something they never ever allowed me to think about or to feel any sort of pressure from.
Thinking back to your first step abroad, this was in the Netherlands. And you said that was the first moment where you actually felt kind of like a shift. You weren't seen as the boy anymore, but you were actually, you know, looked at or seen, perceived as the professional driver that you were, and you felt the pressure rise there. It wasn't just fun go-karting anymore, but this was about performance. How did you deal with the situation?
Well, I'd gone from racing basically from go-karts to racing sort of Formula Ford level cars in New Zealand. Moving to Europe, it felt like I was racing in Formula One just because the level in Europe is so much higher than everything else, especially compared to New Zealand. That when I went over there and I was living in the Netherlands internationally, I was living by myself basically, learning how to sort of look after myself, and then working with the team that was just so much higher level than anything I'd seen before. So that was something that was very different. As a driver as well, there was so many new things that I learned so quickly. It's a lot more, I guess, how do you say, maybe digital in towards Formula One. We go through a huge amount of data and tiny things that I'd never probably picked up on in the past. So I probably learned a huge amount as a driver as well to become better from that first season racing in Europe.
How would you say, looking at it now, like regarding your personal development mentally, how pivotal was this move for you and this time in the Netherlands? You just said having to look after yourself for the first time.
Yeah, it was definitely different. Having obviously lived at home as a kid, it's definitely something that I remember at the time I was just super excited because I had complete independence and I was as far away from my parents as possible. I remember liking the fact that nobody could tell me what to do. But obviously you realize...
Can be nice.
Yeah, it's nice, but it's obviously... Then you realize how far away you are, obviously you probably get homesick at points and you start to miss home. And it's something that that definitely comes with obviously living away and living so far away. but it wasn't something that affected me too much. I was just excited to be racing and racing at, you know, the highest level. That was something that excited me.
And if I'm not mistaken, that's also the time in your life when you started to work together with a mental coach. Is that so?
Yeah, exactly that. So
Enzo Mucci.
Yeah. My first season in Europe. Fortunately, a couple of the guys who support me from New Zealand had also supported other New Zealand racing drivers in the past, guys that were also striving towards Formula One. And they had a connection with a coach that they'd used in the past. So I managed to link up with Enzo in that very first season. So he was somebody that I've now been with him for six years, which is crazy to think about. And he's been somebody that's been massive in that journey. I think that first year in Europe, a lot of the stuff we focused on was a lot more of he was more of a driver coach. So he was, you know, focused on driving tips and looking what the other guys were doing and trying to help me on that side. But obviously that second season, I was then a Red Bull driver and then dealing with the pressure of being a Red Bull driver for the first time, and I'd never experienced anything like that. So that's where his role stepped into a lot more of a mental sort of performance coach role.
Can you let us in on that very moment a little bit more? You said it's something that you've never dealt with before. What did it feel like exactly? What were the thoughts that were going through your mind? And how did you deal with that together with Enzo? What did you speak about, or what were the techniques that you guys practiced together?
Well, I think one of the main differences in our sport compared to most other sports is that specifically in motorsport, there are so many variables that that will basically make up a race and a result. And if just one of those variables goes wrong, or it can affect the result massively. So it a lot of the time is not just down to us and how we drive, but you have to have the right car underneath you. You have to have the right circumstances in a race happen, the weather, tires, how your car's performing, other drivers, obviously. There's so many things that come into it. So a lot of things that are out of your control as well. And that's something that when I became a Red Bull driver, you're trying to give the best result and show that you're good enough to stay in the program. But a lot of the times stuff would happen in races that are out of my control. And I would feel that, you know, potentially my contract was slipping away, that I was being judged, that in that first season, especially, I was racing in FIA Formula 3. And there were a couple of other Red Bull drivers in the championship, but they weren't in the same team as me. And quite often we would be struggling as a team to even qualify within the top 15. It was really a struggle. But then there were other Red Bull drivers that were qualifying in the top 5 and having really good results in other teams. And that was something that I struggled with, basically, because it was kind of out of my control. But I obviously, on paper, I was just getting, you know, annihilated by these other guys. So that's something that Enzo and I worked on, was basically, I guess, focusing on stuff that I could control and trying to put aside the stuff that I couldn't. And ultimately that just makes you drive better.
How simple or easy would you say is it now, or was it back then, for you to differentiate between the two, in your control and out of your control? Because I'm just thinking of 1,000 things in my life that might be out of my control, but I'm totally taking them on. And as you said, you feel your contract slipping away. And I would think this was my responsibility, even though it might not be. How do you differentiate these two? I think this is one of the, life skills everyone should master, really.
It's massively important. And I sucked at it when I first started, when I was in that first year. I made a lot of mistakes as a driver because of the pressure and the stress I would put on myself. Unnecessary crashes. I was very emotional as well. So after a result that I felt like wasn't fair or was out of my control, I was very emotional about it, especially towards Enzo. So luckily, he was good at dealing with that. But I guess the difference then, being a lot younger and being new to all that, to now, is I'd like to say that that I'm able to deal with that pressure and be able to put aside those things that I can't really control. Because I think it's something like we talked about before, is when you're making decisions at obviously extreme speeds, it's very split second decisions. And you know, I guess the strain that you're putting on your minds. If you're overthinking situations, you're going to make mistakes. And it's something I made a lot more mistakes then than I probably do now.
What are the, I don't know, do you have techniques to calm yourself down, or do you know how to take a step back now and analyze the situation faster and therefore calm down quicker? Or what is it that you do?
It's something that comes with age for sure. As you get older, you just get more mature and you learn to deal with situations like that. So that's going to be a massive part of it. But in terms of techniques and things that I would do, obviously every person and every driver is going to be different, and they're going to find things that work for them. A part of the process is, before a race, for me, it's listening to music and obviously staying calm and putting myself in a good zone, and making sure that you're sort of, even things like just breathing techniques, that you're trying to keep your heart rate down and you're breathing clearly and slowly, and not sort of before a race already being I guess too high strung. But versus after a race, yeah, I guess I would say in the early years I probably used Enzo as a punching bag, versus now basically just as you get older you just learn to deal with things like that. Yeah, it's hard to think specific techniques. It would just be a lot of conversations with him, lots of talking and away from the track. Even if it wasn't on a race weekend, I would go and see him, or we'd spend time together. And naturally, when you're especially with Enzo, on the race weekends, every single weekend, every single test session, wherever we went, I would travel with him and stay with him. So shared a lot of hotel rooms over the years, which naturally you just end up talking and spending a lot of time with that person. And because of how he sort of, how his thought process was about life in general and about racing, I naturally just start to learn from how he thinks, and we just have lots of conversations about things, and he would help sort of put aside the things that I couldn't control and just focus on stuff that I actually could control.
So how, what do you think about racing in general? What's his approach here?
For him, the main thing we focused on was very, very simple. And it was basically just putting your thought process into things that you can actually control. Because as we said, you know, in motorsport, there's so many variables that are out of your control that if you focus on them, the only thing they're going to do is add to your stress, and you're not going to drive as well. So the honestly, the main thing we would do is just, and the main thing he would sort of drill into me was to keep the focus on things that you could control. Even if the maximum we could do was qualify P15, to make sure that we were qualifying P15 and not P21 or something like that. And basically, doing the best job that we could in the situation that we were in.
Was he with you as well as you got the call during that big Dutch Grand Prix weekend as well? Did you have a conversation?
Yeah, I did. I had a conversation with him in the morning before everything happened. And that conversation consisted of me venting to him a little bit about how I thought that the Formula One opportunity was slipping away and I wasn't going to get a chance, and that what we could do to make that happen and all this kind of stuff. Two or three hours later, I had to call him back and say,
plot twist.
Hey man, we're actually driving tomorrow. So obviously it all changed very, very quickly, but yes, he was there through that whole experience.
So let's go right there again. Obviously that was one of the most crazy weekends for you in your career, up to date, I'm guessing. We're going to hear that from yourself better in just a second. So just for everyone who's listening, obviously we're talking about a Dutch GP weekend when Liam, when you were going to replace Daniel Ricciardo, who had his hand injured. And I found it so interesting because in your personal Red Bull documentary, which is called In the Wings, which is really recommendable to everyone, go check it out on the website. So it was a crazy situation for you because you had just flown in from Japan where you were still racing Super Formula. You had just, as you said, also, I think, spoken to Franz Tost about the situation, how you were ready, how you, you know, wanted to get your shot. You were doing everything that they were expecting you to do. And then you got the call. And he asks you, are you ready? And you're just like, yes, I am. And as I saw you saying that in the documentary, I was like, okay, but what did you really think in that moment? I mean, obviously you have to sound confident and ready, but how did you actually feel?
Stressed, honestly. It was, yeah, obviously the whole day was a very weird experience. It was, as you said, I'd flown in from Japan. And as reserve, you learn over time that obviously it's a great opportunity, but there's a very good chance that you're never really going to drive the car, that you're basically going to always be on the bench and watching. So although I always tried to keep myself as ready as possible, obviously I was racing in another championship anyway, so I was doing lots of racing at the same time. Mentally, I was never, you get to the point where you go, probably not going to race this weekend, and it's going to be like any other weekend as reserve, which is how I probably went into Zandvoort. So yeah, I arrived on the Friday morning, and had the conversation with Enzo about how I thought everything was sort of slipping away. And one of the things I spoke to him about was how I wanted to speak with Helmut Marko and talk to him about where I was at, what my sort of plans were for next year, what my chances were of driving. And so it's something I spoke to Enzo about, how to, I guess, approach that meeting. Then I went and had that meeting with Helmut, and we spoke about quite a few things. Most of the meeting consisted of just me basically selling my soul to him about why I thought I should be driving. And then basically in the end, obviously the crash happens, but something that became very clear very quickly was that it wasn't clear that they were going to put me in the car. So the crash happens, and obviously as reserve, I was at first I thought, okay, I'm next in line, this, I'm going to be driving the car. But when I went and spoke to the people I needed to speak to Franz, specifically, they were talking about, they had to make a decision on what to do. And I knew that Daniel's hand was broken, so I knew that the only thing they could be deciding was who to put in the car. And the fact that it was a decision meant I needed to basically show that I was confident and ready, and that they could trust putting, you know, a rookie like me at the time in the car. So I went and found Helmut again, and basically almost faked all his confidence to show that I was ready for this opportunity. And basically they gave it to me.
How did you feel faking that confidence? You just said you were trying to sell yourself. How do you feel doing that?
I definitely, it was fake. So obviously I had self-belief. I had enough self-belief for Formula One. It wasn't that I didn't think that I was ready. I definitely felt ready for Formula One, but in the specific situation I was in, I was going to have one practice session on one of the hardest tracks on the calendar. And I knew the whole weekend was going to be wet, in mixed conditions. So no matter how ready for a championship you feel, when you're jumping in mid-season and you're going into a sort of really crazy situation like that, you can only feel so ready. So I'd never driven the car before. I knew that I really didn't have much time. So obviously, I'm realistic about things, and I knew it was going to be very, very tough. So it's something that when they made the call that I was going to drive, it was very stressful. I felt a lot of emotions, a lot of pressure, but I had so much work to do over that Friday night to get ready that basically by the time I'd gone through everything, I was sitting in the car for the practice session.
Yeah, man, let's speak about that one as well, because obviously being fresh and, clear in your mind and brain matters big time when, sitting or stepping into this car, and you didn't sleep at all. You had to do all this work all night. How did you experience this? These few hours before your big gig?
It was just busy. Yeah, it was just really, really busy. Lots of going through procedures, operational stuff on how to use the car, how to drive and operate it. And then basically the main difference is I'd driven F1 before in practice sessions in the past, not that specific car, but so I knew how to drive and operate the car mostly. So that was more of a refresher, but it was procedures like pit stops, race starts, you know, using different tire compounds, doing a race distance versus doing just a test session. All that stuff was completely new going into qualifying and trying to extract everything out of a lap in a Formula One car on a wet surface was pretty tricky. So that was the stuff preparing for that was more difficult and was what kept it so busy, basically.
And you just said, I mean, my confidence was fake, but it still worked out pretty well. You managed to do this first race of yours more than well, finished 13th in that one, and then had four pretty solid, let's put it that way, GPs after that. How did you, in terms of confidence, how did you feel going out of this fifth GP of yours in Qatar?
Finishing the whole stint, I felt... I guess it's hard to honestly look back, like looking back on the whole five races, they're very blurry to look back on. It was such a busy period of my life that it took over everything. Obviously it completely consumed my life at that point. And I knew it was so important that it was just very, very busy. So looking back on it, it's hard to remember specifics. But I remember finishing off in Qatar and knowing that I wasn't going to be driving the next race. It was pretty sad, honestly, because obviously we sort of pursue this crazy opportunity our whole lives. A lot of drivers obviously fall just short of F1 as well. And it was amazing to have that opportunity, but obviously I'm aiming to be a full-time driver. And I knew that those races I was doing was more of a test as well at the same time, sort of a test for my future and to show that I was ready for Formula One. So I tried to do that the best way I could in those races. And then I guess finishing off, it was realizing that now there's not really so much I can do anymore. There's not really much more I can do to prove myself. I just kind of have to now sit and wait a little bit and let things play out.
And that's really how you can see it. I'm just thinking back to Enzo's approach, you know, differentiating between what's in your control and what's not. But like, just from an ego point of view, if I'm an athlete and I want to achieve my goals, I want to be in that car. And I don't think I could be like, okay, I did my best. This was a great chance. Was that really how you could see it in that moment?
You look back on it and there's things I'd say I'm a perfectionist and obviously nothing's ever perfect. So you never have a perfect race or realistically it's very hard to even achieve a perfect lap. So to look back on the whole experience, I looked back on it and obviously wished in certain situations that I'd done things differently. It's not to say that I wasn't happy with the whole sort of, the result as a whole, I think I was reasonably happy with, but I definitely looked back and thought that there's things I could have done better. And that's something that I guess is more of a learning experience, looking back on it, trying to find things to learn from rather than dwell on, but basically to try and learn from it and then use that for sort of future experiences.
That does sound very mature. And it's crazy for you if you can actually see it that way, man. Let's come from this one to the moment when they actually told you that you were not going to get that seat. Obviously, everyone, I guess, who's listening to this watched Drive to Survive in your episode and felt with you going into that room, getting those news, coming back out. And then, you know, even that interview after where you're like, no, this should have been my seat. Can you take us with you into that room, like onto that roller coaster of emotions? Because going in, I was thinking you were going to get, like, I knew how it was turning out, but I was convinced that you were going to get that seat.
I think, yeah, obviously I very quickly realized that doing these races was going to be a test for my future. And I knew that before Zandvoort, it wasn't looking very likely that I would be competing in Formula One. And then I had this crazy opportunity to show something. And I knew that realistically, it didn't matter too much what I'd done in the past, but I was going to be judged on these races. Obviously, Formula One teams care about how you do in Formula One, and this is what I'd be judged on. So the goal from the start was to prove why I should be in Formula One, and it's why every weekend, as a team. Obviously myself, Enzo with me as well, put everything into trying to deliver the absolute best result possible in every single lap that I competed in, basically over those races. So I felt like it was early to make that call. It was Singapore when I got told. And I guess I knew that that meant that they'd kind of decided probably a bit before Singapore as well. And I hadn't finished my, you know, stint of races yet. I felt like I hadn't shown everything that I had to give.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And it made the rest quite difficult, because I then went on to have the two best results that I had in those races immediately afterwards. So obviously it was a frustrating thing to deal with.
A frustrating thing to deal with, I guess. But like, leaving that room, how did you feel? Would you say disheartened or frustrated, I guess, but at the same time, and this brings us back to the beginning of the conversation, being a reserve driver, you can't really afford to not be at 100, because you could be called on at any time, and also you still had another race to go.
Yeah, it was more frustrating than anything. It was more it's just feeling like you're sort of getting overlooked. And it was right before qualifying in Singapore that I was told as well. So I then went on to have a really great qualifying and score points in the race. And it sort of made the whole weekend a little bit tough, because, you know, the whole team was super, super happy with the result. And I was happy with the result, but in the back of my mind, the whole weekend, it was basically, I had that thought of, you know, well, I'm not going to be, you know, no matter what I do now, I'm not going to be driving next year. So it was something that's, I guess, like we said before, trying to put that thought process into things that were more positive and more in my control. Obviously, what's out of my control is that I'm not going to be driving next year. That decision's been made. But I still have a couple of races to show why I should be in Formula One. And that was really the goal for the rest of the remainder of the races and time that I had in the car, was to basically just try and perform and show reason to be in Formula One in the future.
Oh, man. Yeah, we definitely felt that one with you for sure. And I used the word roller coaster in the beginning, you know, the roller coaster of emotions from coming from Japan, being called upon for this big chance of yours, the dream that you've always had in your mind. And I guess after Singapore, you were kind of rather on the way down mentally, but I feel like usually the roller coaster goes back up, right? And let's just imagine for one second together, if you were to be called to step up, leave the reserve role again, take a full seat, what are you manifesting this moment to be like for you?
I think I basically just am trying to stay ready. And obviously now that I had that opportunity, that brief stint in Formula One, it's made everything a lot more real. As I said before F1, you always imagine what it's like, but you never really know what it's like. So as a driver, you have self-confidence. You tell yourself that you're good enough and you have that self-belief that you're good enough. But obviously, realistically, you never really know until you drive the car. And I've now done basically all of that and experienced all of it, and I know what it's like. So it gives a different perspective on being on the bench now and watching and seeing it from the sidelines. It gives a different perspective, but at the same time, it's something that for me, I know that I'm ready for it. So if that opportunity comes, it's basically, yeah, being ready again to be able to step back in. And I guess hopefully the next time, if I get that chance, it's not as a reserve, but obviously as a full-time driver.
What would that mean to you then?
It's obviously what we as drivers work towards our whole life. It's something that not just me, but my family and a lot of people behind me have worked towards. So it'd be a huge success and accomplishment for everybody around me and my team. And for me, obviously, it'd be a big step in my career. Obviously, it's a step. It's not the ultimate goal. It's being a Formula One driver, but, you know, we're not here just to race in Formula One as well. We're obviously here to win and to be the best.
That's actually what you said at the end of your documentary, which I found striking, really. You said your goal and your vision is to win a world championship. It's not only to race in Formula One. And I mean, you also were already mentioned how tough it is as a Kiwi even to make it into Formula One. You're there, but then to win the whole thing is just crazy. Would you say that there's any point for you still that you could feel proud, or I mean, contentment is the wrong word, obviously, but like feel happy with what you achieved, even though you might not be at the very top at the world champion situation yet?
Truthfully, no. It's not something that, you know, I didn't, you know, as a driver, I didn't work, and everybody around me didn't work this hard for this long to just drive in Formula One. So no, I wouldn't be completely satisfied. The goal has always been to basically win in Formula One. And I think as a kid, you know, being 5 years old and realizing what Formula One was and realizing and that it's the highest level of motorsport. Obviously that desire for Formula One was always because it was the highest level, not because I liked the cars or because I thought they looked the coolest or something like that. I do think that, but the desire was because it's the highest level. And it's always been something that I've sort of in any situation I've wanted to be the best at. So I guess that's why it's not just about competing in Formula One, but it's about winning.
Liam, thank you so much for crossing our fingers for you. We can't wait to see you back out there on the tracks of this world.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Liam. This was a really cool conversation. And personally, I loved how he took us on the way to the most crucial moments of his career, really. And especially, I appreciate his honesty of faking his confidence in the moment of truth. That was really cool. If you want to learn more about Liam, go check out the In the Wings documentary that we talked about as well. You can find it on redbull.com, and I can tell you it was a great watch, so it's definitely a recommendation. I'll be back on Thursday with York, as usual, to look back on Liam's and my conversation to see what we can learn from it and even apply to our daily lives, even if we're not professional F1 drivers. Also, we would love to hear from you, and I cannot stress this enough. Please reach out and share your stories with us, or if these episodes are helping or motivating you in any kind of way, you can do that by either leaving a review or a comment on whatever platform you're listening or watching, or you can reach us via email on mindsetwin@redbull.com. Make sure you hit follow or subscribe on your preferred platform as well. And also check out our brand new Mindset Win YouTube channel. We would love to see you there. And thank you for listening today. See you on Thursday.